Hola, bonjour, hello. Let me ask you a question. Do you think it's possible to have a world language class where instead of teaching the language, the rules, and the vocab, you and your students use the language to enjoy learning about each other and the world? I hope your answer is a big yes, because that's exactly what you will discover inside Growing with Proficiency, the podcast. My name is Claudia Elliott, a Spanish teacher born and raised in Colombia, who is as passionate as you are to support our learners to grow in their proficiency and cultural competence. My goal is that in this podcast you find clarity, strategies, ideas, and inspiration that you can bring into your classroom the next day. Are you ready? Get comfortable while I grab my cafecito colombiano and let's start this conversation now. Hola, bonjour, hello. Welcome to a new episode of Growing with Proficiency, the podcast where we talk all about second language acquisition. I am Claudia Elliott, your host, and today is the second part of a great conversation that we're having with Dr. Bill Van Patten about, of course, second language acquisition. So if you haven't listened to the first one, I want you to stop this one and go back to our prior episode where Dr. Bill Van Patten talks a little bit about the role of input, the essential role of input, and how that input or that role is not a hypothesis anymore, but a fact. And also he talks a little bit about the nature of language and the language development and what should be our content in our classes. And today we're going to keep talking and we're going to address the big elephant in the room, which is the role of grammar instruction. So welcome back, Dr. Bill Van Patten, and let's start with that big question. Let's talk a little bit about what is the role of grammar instruction in our language classes.
Let me just back up because I want to say something. I made a note to myself, and I thought about this right as you started to ask this question about focus on form and grammar. So let me back up and remind people of something, because you talked about slow, piecemeal, and stage-like earlier. And I was mentioning child language acquisition. Teachers are the most impatient people in the world. And it's partly forced on them. And teachers tend to think in terms of semesters, terms, years, and so on, which is the wrong way to think about language acquisition. Let's take the average child learning a first language. And you've probably read this somewhere. I've written this and I've talked about this before. A child learning a first language by the age of 5, when he or she starts kindergarten in the United States, has got a lot of language, a lot of language, which is why they can go to school at the age of 5. But they don't have an adult-like system yet. It is not native-like. A lot is there, but it is far from adult-like. Now, how many hours has that child spent learning, acquiring language prior to going to kindergarten? Because they're not in school, right? All they're doing is learning language. They're playing and learning language. They're eating at the dinner table, they're learning language. So whatever they're doing, they're learning. That's language acquisition for them. So if you do something conservative, like 8 hours a day for 4 years, forget the first year when they're babbling, even though we know they're learning language. I just told you about the experiments with the sucking, how we know they're getting sounds in their heads and blah, blah, blah. So I've done some calculation, and off the top of my head, I don't remember the exact number, but by the time a child starts school, he or she has been involved in something like 12 to 13,000 hours of language acquisition. And they're still not native-like. Now, a child starting in English, starting school, does not have passives yet, passives down. So the cow was kicked by the horse, and the horse kicked the cow. Even though those mean the same thing, the child tends to interpret the cow was kicked by the horse as the cow kicking the horse. Mm-hmm. And the horse kicked the cow, the horse kicked the cow. It's not until about the age of 8, 7 or 8, that children start to show differentiation between passive and active. So they don't quite have them all. So it's not until like the age of 9 where they're getting more and more accurate. So how many more hours have they been engaged in language acquisition to get a distinction between passive and actives? And we're still not done. There have been research on adults that show that there's a distinction between college-educated adults and non-college-educated adults. They both have passives in their systems. So the horse was kicked by the cow. But the college-educated adults make fewer errors in interpretation and are faster at understanding passives compared to non-college-educated adults overall. And so we're talking about people in their 20s and 30s now. So this idea that language acquisition happens in some short time frame of a year or 2 years, Spanish 1, Spanish 2, Spanish 3, Spanish 4, is utterly ridiculous. Maybe. Teachers, we've got to stop thinking in terms of years and semesters and terms and start thinking of hours. So you're a Spanish teacher. How many hours are your learners in Spanish inside Spanish the way a child is?
Oh my gosh, just
in 1 year.
Yeah, in 1 year is, let me think, I have never made the calculation, but I see them every other day for 90 minutes and we have 120 days. So that's 120 hours. I mean, like, it would be more, but then they don't come to class or they, I mean, like, whatever. It's just around 100, a little bit more than 100. Right. For 1 year. So let's say that they're in a program, and most students are in a 2-year program because they don't feel that they're making a progress and they don't feel successful and they just are not, you know, not happy. So they don't go to the third year. So we have a lot of programs with 2 years. So that would be like 200 plus hours compared to that.
Right. And so what demands were we making on ourselves as teachers and on our learners with so limited hours? Language acquisition, again, as you quoted me earlier saying, it's not really amenable to these external forces to make something happen that's not going to happen. Language acquisition has its own course of development and its own time frame. Plus, there are individual differences too. This is the biggest kept secret of child language acquisition. You can take 100 children at the age of 2, and they will not be in the same place in terms of language development. Some will be further along than others.
I know.
That's just
because English is terrible for me. I mean, you don't know how I struggle with this language. And I know that I had people that are here for the same time of years that I have, and they are so much better. They sound so much better. They write so much better. And I know for a fact that it's so different depending on the person.
Right. And so what happens is these individual differences with language acquisition, we bring them from our childhood and first language acquisition. So if we were, again, you take 100 2-year-olds and they're going to be in different places. Well, you take those same people 20 years later learning Spanish or French, and they're going to be in different places because that's what they were as children. It's just built into them. And so all those kind of things factor into how we think about classes and time on task and so on. Okay, now let's get back to your question about, is there a place for grammar, pop-up grammar, focus on form, and so on? My answer is always the following. It's whatever you want it to be, as long as you don't think that's causing acquisition or takes the place of acquisition. End of story. What I do with quote unquote grammar, and I don't use grammar the way teachers use grammar, is I let the learners tell me when they want to know something. So if they're struggling to express something, and I'll say, oh, you mean conoció? Huh? Yeah, that's what you want to say, conoció. Okay, keep going. And I don't even have to tell them what it means. You know, I don't have to tell them, explain it or anything like that. Just they need to know what that little thing means at that point in time and how it's used. Because I let them tell me that. And I'm not talking about them asking questions. Well, what's the difference between this and that? No, I'm talking about when they are actively engaged in communication or they don't understand something I say. And I can tell it might be quote unquote language related. And so in the moment of communication, You know, you say, oh yeah, you say it this way. End of story. You keep going.
So it's just for the purpose of communication. It's continuing communication.
Right, right. Because otherwise, if you do anything different, you're always going to be pulled like a magnet back to explaining more, and so on. Now, what I learned over the years in teaching, and I'm going to use teaching now in the sense teaching, is that when I changed all my testing, all my grades, how I evaluated people in my class and so on, I stopped getting questions I used to get 20 years before.
Mm-hmm.
Because that idea, is this going to be on the test, is no longer existent.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no test on this. And so I get different questions I get the question, how do you say this? Oh, here's how you say it. Mm-hmm. I guess those are the kind of questions I get. So I always tell people the grammar question is, you can do whatever you want in your classroom, long as you don't fool yourself thinking it's going to make some big difference, because it's not.
Yeah.
But if it makes you feel good, makes the students feel good at that point in time to say, oh, you put an accent there, you know, make the let's not hablo, es hablo. You have to put the stress on the end to make it past tense for he, right? If you want to say that out loud and it makes you feel good, makes students feel good, fine, you can do that. But that doesn't mean that now they're acquiring that, or that they cause them to acquire it. No, that's just not how acquisition works, right? But those things can have an affective, you know, with an A, affective thing, just makes people feel good at that moment that they did that. And so if that makes people feel good, do it.
So if that is what makes you happy, just do it. Let's talk a little bit about input. We talk a lot about input in the role, the essential role for acquisition. Let's talk about output. And I know that there is an obsession about output, and I think it's so evident in most of the textbooks, because you open it and the first activity is write, discuss, say. I mean, there is no like a reading, there is not a text, there is no language before. So what is the role of output in all this second language acquisition journey?
The role of output is what it is in communication, because communication is expression and interpretation of meaning in a given context for a given purpose. So from the learner's point of view, you express meaning, you make output because you have something to say. Not because I make you say something, or because I want you to speak in a complete sense, because you have something to say. And I, as the facilitator in your life, the teacher facilitator, understand the following about communication and how output evolves over time. It's a very gradual process from what we call interlocutor dependence or interactional dependence to interactional independence. I'm talking about when it's, you know, two or more people talking or signing or whatever you're doing. As a teacher, I have to understand that my learners at the beginning stages can't make output. They're completely dependent on me. Mm-hmm. I have to scaffold all the interaction. I have to lead discussion, lead things. And so they're going to raise their hands. They're going to shout, see, no, they're going to throw one word out, blah, blah, blah. But they cannot initiate. They cannot carry on a conversation. They are dependent. And over time, as language grows in their heads, they will make a very slow move toward what we call independence, right? So there might be a middle phase. Independence means, for example, now I can be a full-fledged conversational partner. I can initiate topics. I can interrupt you. I can add points. Oh yeah, I agree with you. And here's why, you know, I can change the topic. I now have I can do all the things that make me fully interactional. Along the way, you could probably, if you mapped it out, find like stage-like development, just like language. So you might get to an intermediate point where you're still dependent and you're still reacting
yes.
to the other person, but not the way you were before. You might be able to ask a question now and then, or you might, instead of just using one sentence, you might actually put two sentences together to respond to something, or, you know, and you just see that growth over time in terms of interaction ability. But you just cannot, as a teacher, not understand that that output has to move from dependence to independence. And it's going to take a long time. Again, hours. The question of how many hours, right? So this idea of let's speak in complete sentences, or they won't learn if they don't speak in complete sentences, or they need to make output. There's too much emphasis on output, at least for language acquisition. Making output does not get language in your head, by the way. Input gets language in your head, right? What output gets you is your ability, when you interact with people. So Frank, let's just look at my Spanish 1 class, right? So I'm doing most of the lifting, quite the heavy lifting in the interaction, right? And so my students are going, no. And I'll say something like, okay, so here we got this picture of this guy. And I'm saying in Spanish, let's give him a name. And he's got freckles and red hair. Okay, so what kind of name goes with freckles and red hair? I say that in Spanish. And somebody goes, Opie, because they remember Andy Griffith. Or they'll say, some famous person with freckles, right? Or something like that. So se llama Opie, right? So his name is Opie. And they're like totally engaged in this. And I'm doing all, okay. And where was I going with this?
On the output.
Oh, on output. When they are engaged with their one answer is Opie, or if I say, okay, so I'm comparing pictures, right? So here's Opie and here's another guy who doesn't have freckles and he has dark hair and blue eyes. So we're going to give him his name. And I'll say, does he have tiene pecas? Does he have freckles? And they go, no. Okay, great. Notice how they're saying no. When they interact with me like that, they're making me talk more. Mm-hmm. They're getting more input from me. They're getting more interaction from me. So the role of output, no matter how minimal it is to get other people to keep interacting with you.
Oh, wow.
Right? And so the little kids do this really well. They'll babble, they'll speak in one words, whatever, and they get the parents to talk to them all the time. And with the most minimal amount of language. And it's through that language that they're getting is that the language grows in their heads. So as I'm doing this thing with Opie and maybe this guy's name is David, I don't know what. And so we're making this story up about Opie and David. And then, you know, I walk around with the picture and I'll put it next to somebody's face and I'll say, you know, say, parecen, do they look alike? No. And then they get, maybe there's somebody with freckles in the class and I put the Opie picture next to say, parecen, and they go, a little bit. I said, un poco. Oh, yeah, un poco. They'll repeat after me when they, you know, they pick words up real quick like that. And then next thing you know, they're saying all these things that get me to do stuff in language, which is what they need.
And then like really foster that engagement.
Right. And so it's the long as you understand that they're output is going to be minimal in the sense. It's not going to be sentential. It's going to be one word. They might shout things out in English and I have to recast it in Spanish for them and they'll pick it up as they go and so on. But if they're showing that level of engagement, that makes me do my job, which is provide more comprehensible input and more interesting and compelling input, right? If they're not interacting and they're not doing anything, then the input is useless because that means I'm just talking at them.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be talking with them. So again, so the role of output is always going to be acquisition, whether you're in the beginning stages or the more advanced stages, getting people to talk to you, getting people to interact with you. That's how you learn language, getting people to interact with you somehow, right? However, and you know, the same thing with written text. How do you get a written text that works for you? You know, there's all kinds of ways we can talk about that, reading and so on, but we don't have enough time today, so.
I'm going to have to invite you again. But let me ask you this question, because I think you made this statement and you made these bold statements that I just have to like think about them for so long. And you said, you know, a comprehensible input is essential for acquisition, but doesn't guarantee acquisition.
Right.
Tell me more.
Because remember that acquisition is in the mind of the learner.
Mm-hmm.
And input is the essential data source that the mind operates on. But just because you're getting exposed to input or comprehensive input doesn't mean you're going to acquire language like everybody else. So again, there are individual differences. Some people go further. Some people don't go as far along. Some people are faster. Some people are slower. So the fact that you're getting exposed to the same input doesn't guarantee that everybody's going to be at the same place at the same time. No, it doesn't guarantee that everybody is going to be native-like. There's something about second language acquisition that means that most people are probably going to be somewhere, some part of their language, some part of the communication, or all parts of it, or who knows what, people different, are going to be non-native-like. That's just the nature of second language acquisition. It could be time on task. We're not sure why. We have actually no answer to that. Some people think it's because you have a first language in your head and that leaks in and blah, 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 and this and that. Maybe, maybe not. We just don't really know. So while input is absolutely essential, you won't acquire without it, it doesn't mean you're going to be native-like in the end because there are other factors that affect second language acquisition and third language acquisition and fourth language acquisition.
What do you think we can do? What will be your advice for all the teachers that email me, that put in Facebook, I just don't know, my students are not making progress, I don't know what to do, my students are not engaged. And with, you know, the major concern for me is that we're not getting students acquiring languages, which I think as a society is such a detriment for our society. It is not to have more people speaking different languages, where we're in a country with so many languages and some of them dying, sadly, because we are not having people valuing language. So what would be something that we all can do, something that teachers can do or focus more right now?
I'm going to be really harsh. If your students seem uninterested, it's because you're doing something that's not interesting. End of story. And I know, how do I want to say this? I've never had that problem with students. Even when I was teaching Spanish way back when, before I knew all things, classrooms, there's a saying about input for teaching that not only must it be comprehensible, but it must be compelling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last class I taught at Michigan State, I had near perfect attendance for the entire semester. All 25 students in my class came every day. They loved being there. And they gave me a perfect score for the class, and they gave the class a perfect score in our evaluations at the end, right? And I reflected on that, and that made me think about classes I've taught more generally and so on. And this was a class a lot of my colleagues didn't like. They go, oh, I hate teaching that class. I go, I'll teach it. What do you mean you hate that class? And I love that class, and we just had the best time. And something, teachers have to find something within themselves to let go. You have to be an actor. You have to be a comedian. You have to put yourself out there. I know it's hard, particularly in the K-12 system. It's a little easier in the university system. But in the K-12 system, it's a little bit harder. But you have to let your guard down. Teachers have to be people. Mm-hmm. Students have to want to connect with you. And you have to want to connect with students or as learners, right? And find the things that are compelling. I'll give you an example. This class I was talking about, the ones where students came every day, they never missed. We were talking one day about, we just watched a clip from Pan's Labyrinth, the first clip, because I divided the movie up into little segments. And we use that as like gossip to talk about. And I don't know if you know the movie, El Laberinto del Del Fountain. Do you know that one?
Yes.
Okay. And so Ophelia, the little girl and her mother, you know, remember the mother, the father is dead and the mother's going to marry that, that fascist captain guy. And the little girl has a very, very tight relationship with her mother. So I mentioned, you know, I taught them una relación estrecha.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just asked them, I said, in Spanish, I said, how many of you have a close relationship with your mother, like Ophelia? Most of them raised their hand. And this one guy just said out of the blue sky, he had a very heavy accent. He said, I have a very close relationship with my mother. I go, really? I go, what? Give us an example. Why is it close? He goes, I write to her every night. The whole class looks at him. I go, you write to her every night? He goes, yeah, email. This is all in Spanish. He goes, email. This is a third year class. He goes, email. I go, you send your mother an email every night? And I was incredulous. And I did it just like that. He goes, yeah. And then I asked the class, how many of you send your mother an email every night? No. Nobody. How many call your mother every night?
Nobody.
And then you know what he said out loud? He goes, and now I'm going to do what he said in Spanish. He goes, porque yo soy un mami's boy. And so the whole class just cracked up. And but he was being serious. And I said, oh, and whatever we're going to, I don't even remember what I had planned that day. I said, huh. And I put the expression on the board and I said, okay, what are the characteristics of a mommy's boy? And the class started shouting things out and we would kept going back to him. Is that true for you? Kind of, sort of, this would happen. And so I go, okay, now, like, let's talk about, is there such a thing as a dad? Anybody here a daddy's girl? Two girls are there. Are you a daddy's girl? Yeah. Okay. So then we'd characterize They drove the class.
Mm-hmm.
They made it compelling. He did that. And I was not about to let it go. Mm-hmm. Because the minute I saw the class's face, I went, okay, I got to go with they are. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do whatever notes I had for that day is like went out the window, which was fine.
Yes. And I think it's fine for the other case too, is when you bring that topic or you bring that question and then you don't get any answer and you want to keep on because that's what you plan. And right. That was your lesson. And that was like, oh, I'm not going to let go of this, but it just doesn't happen for that class.
Right. And this is why I always tell people why understanding the nature of communication is so important.
Mm-hmm.
The teachers are not taught anything at all about language, second language acquisition, or the nature of communication, how it happens, and what it's used for, and what its purpose is, and so on. They think they're teaching communicatively, and they're not. Man, that I cannot tell you how many times that semester with that class, it was the same thing. I'd go in with an idea, boom, it'd go out the window after, you know, somebody brings something up. And we'd go with it. And then, you know, I tend to think fast on my feet. So I was able to scramble, you know, all the time and do stuff. And then I always did give them homework though too, just so they felt that they were part of a class. So like that day, here's a good example. That day I said, okay. I said, you all have to come tomorrow now with a list of characteristics for a mommy's boy, a daddy's girl. And then I want you to come up with your own list because we didn't get to this. A daddy's boy and a mommy's girl. Are they all the same? You'd go home and write your list, bring them tomorrow. And they did. They came back. They were like fascinated by this topic. And then I don't know how another one came up at one in a class one time. This kid goes, I had introduced using the concept. Oh, we were talking about relationship with parents again, and it was I had like a little structured input activity that I was doing just to feed the conversation. So I said, check if these are true for you or not. And it was like, lo admiro, lo detesto, lo respeto, this kind of thing. For, you know, I admire him, I respect him, blah, 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 which was true for you with your dad. And so this one kid raises his hand. He goes, lo odio. And I go, lo odias. Oh. Lo odias a tu papá. And he goes, no, mi hermano. And the next thing you know, we're off about sibling rivals. I mean, the whole class just went off and they're about relations with brothers and sisters. Well, that was not all what I had planned, what we were going to talk about. And there you go. And that's what you got to do. The minute, I mean, and to have kids volunteer stuff like that about themselves is really great. But then you also have to do it about yourself too. If people want to know you, you cannot be the stranger in the class conducting. You've got to be part of that communicative environment and part of that community of speakers. And that's the hardest part for teachers because, again, K through 12 is a little bit different because they're, you know, you're in Florida right now, there are things you can't say about yourself in Florida or you get fired. But we have to figure out ways to do this, and it's unique to everybody. So going back to what you said earlier, what can we do? I said, you've got to be compelling. Topics have to be compelling, and you as a teacher have to be compelling. You have to find it. You have to pull it out of yourself. You've got to say, okay, I got to stop being a teacher. And I got, you know, it's like being a parent again with a 2 or 3 year old. Why did that child want to interact with me so much? Why was I a good parent? Well, now I'm going to do that in my classroom, right? That kind of thing. So,
yeah, I agree. And I think communication, and that's so hard because communication cannot be imposed. Like, it's just very difficult. And we are in a, I'm teaching a K-12, I teach high school, but imposing to a 15 or 14 that has to communicate with me is very difficult. It's just extremely, I mean, you have a few students who come to your class and they will do everything that you say and they will just, you know, be in compliance because that's the type of students who they are. But most of our students are not like that. And because of the nature of our classes and communication, that component of connection and make it compelling or talking as people is just really important in my class. This has been such a great conversation and I have so many more questions to answer, but we are going to keep it to 1 hour and I will send you another message to invite you again. And maybe I get lucky twice and you say yes. But before we go, I want you to tell us about your work that you're doing as a writer now. I am so interested in that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I still have one foot in the academic door, the SLA door. You know, I'm doing a second edition of While We're on the Topic with ACTFL now. So that book will come out sometime this fall. And then I've got some other things I'm doing and, you know, a couple of research things that'll wrap those up and I won't do any more research. But I got some books that are revising, like I say, while we're on the topic and some others. I got the foot in that door, but I spend most of my time now writing fiction. I was writing fiction in Spanish for learners. My cuentos cortos, those, by the way, those of you Spanish teachers looking for something interesting for your students that's compelling, check out my cuentos cortos, go to inputandmore.com. And you can pick and choose. We can talk about that. People can write to me about that. But these little flash fiction pieces of 400 words or less get students really motivated and the activities that go with them. So I'm writing fiction in Spanish for learners, but then I'm writing fiction in English for just adults, you know, for the regular fiction market. So I just published my 5th novel called Refuge, working on my 6th novel.
Oh, wow.
I've done 3 collections of short stories. I'm working on my 4th one. It's finished. It's in various phases of being edited and so on. And I just had my 7th story published in a anthology or magazine. I think I published in 2023 and 20 so far, I published like, I think 10 things in magazines and anthologies, short stories. So yeah, I'm doing that and it's kind of fun.
That is fantastic. Yeah. I didn't know. I knew that you were writing, but I didn't know that it was this prolific. Like, you've been writing a lot.
Yeah. In fact, you can. I'll sell it. Send everybody to my website. It's really easy. It's Bill Van Patten. Make sure you spell it correctly. BillVanPatten.net. So go to BillVanPatten.net, and you'll go to my fiction website. You can see what I'm up to there. I've won some a couple of awards too, so that's been fun.
Congratulations. So, I am going to put all those links in the show notes and in my blog for people who want to do it and get your, if you teach Spanish, get the cuentos cortos. This has been great. I mean, it has been such a great conversation. I have learned a lot, and I just really hope that everybody that is listening is just taking notes, and this is an episode that can come back and listen. I am so grateful for your work, and I really hope that you can keep that feet on the second language acquisition field and don't let it go. Just get there, just stay there, because we just need that. So don't plan to remove that feet. We appreciate that feet. I am so grateful.
Until someone slams the door on my foot, then
Oh, whack, no, no, that's not going to happen. I don't see that's coming. I just want to say thank you. Thank you again for taking this time. It has been a great conversation. I have enjoyed every single second.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you to your listeners for listening to me. I'm happy to come back at some point down the road if you want to talk some more. So let me know when.
Okay, I will. Okay, so did you hear that? That, you know, he said that next time that I send an invite is going to have been accepted. So hopefully we can make it happen. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And have a great week. Nos vemos pronto y chao, chao.